One of the reasons I'm doing these science news episodes is that sometimes there's a news item which touches on a really deep question, but it's so technical that no one dares talk about it. This new research is such a case. It's an experiment that looked at the question of whether aging is reversible in glass. Yes, it'd be more interesting if it was people rather than glass, but we have to start somewhere, right? So why not with glass? And to the researchers' surprise, they found that aging in glass is indeed reversible, with some caveats. Let's have a look. The deep question which this research touches on is why time in our universe seems to pass only in one way. Why do volcanoes erupt but not unerupt? Why do eggs break but not unbreak? Why do we get older but never younger? Yes, it's entropy increase, or so we're told. But the thing is, if aging is just entropy increase, then you should be able to reverse it by decreasing entropy, right? This is what Maxwell's famous thought experiment with the demon illustrates. Maxwell said, suppose I have two boxes of gas, one with high temperature, that's red, and one with low temperature, that's blue. As long as the boxes are separated, the gases are very ordered and entropy is low. But now I mix the gases. Entropy will increase until they reach some equilibrium temperature. The second law of thermodynamics now says that once you've reached maximum entropy and the equilibrium temperature, the entropy can't decrease. So the gases won't spontaneously unmix, and that's certainly what we observe in nature. Maxwell's demon now puts a wall in the middle of the gas box with an opening. Each time there's a fast gas molecule approaching the opening, he lets it through. If there's a slow one, he keeps it closed. The effect is that over time, the temperature on the right side increases again, so entropy goes down. Maxwell came up with this to say that something's fishy with the second law of thermodynamics. But physicists understand today that what's actually happening is that the demon needs to have information about which gas molecules are fast and which are not. If he has information, he needs to have order, so low entropy. The demon can therefore use this information to decrease the entropy. But the total entropy of the demon and the gas still increases, so no problem with the second law of thermodynamics. The thing is now that, for all we know, this is generally and always true. If you have information, you can decrease entropy. And with that, you can, in principle, turn around any process in time, including aging of materials or anything really, in principle. In practice, well, we can't. Or otherwise, Brian Johnson would spend his money on physics and not on dietary supplements. But in the past decade or so, physicists have managed to actually do this time reversal in some cases. This is maybe one of the most exciting research you've never heard of. It makes headlines every now and then as saying that physicists have reversed time or something like that. There was an example of a really neat experiment by a group of researchers from MIT in 2017, where they set up a cloud of atoms so that heat actually flowed from the cold to the hot part. I know this sounds kind of lame, heat flows what? But look, this is the time reverse of what had naturally happened. But in their experiment, they exploited quantum effects or entanglement in particular. This can be done because entanglement can store information that can then be used to seemingly decrease entropy. The issue is that so long as we're talking about quantum stuff, the time changes are fairly simple, both mathematically and in reality. They're easy to understand and keep track of. Make the thing larger, move it out of the quantum realm, and you have irreversibility creeping back in. Physicists believe that this is just seemingly irreversible, but believing and seeing are two different things. And this now brings me to the new paper. The authors of the paper looked very closely at a type of glass. Why glass? Because glass is known to age at a period that we can observe. It settles rather slowly into its final state. Or as the researchers put it in the paper, the glasses are subject to physical aging because their state relaxes continuously towards a state of metastable equilibrium. I think that continuous relaxation towards a state of metastable equilibrium is generally a good description for aging. The thing is now that whether this aging process is reversible or not depends on the type of fluctuations in the material. The researchers measured this by scattering light on the material sample and then very precisely looked at the tiny changes in what came back. To their own surprise, they found that the fluctuations they saw are of the reversible type. That's a surprise because the theoretical prediction was that it should be irreversible. As they write in the paper, we are not aware of a theoretical framework that predicts material time statistical reversibility of fluctuations during aging. Now, let me be clear. It's not like they reversed these fluctuations. They just found out that they're reversible. Though they also caution in the paper that just because one type of process seems to be reversible in those materials doesn't mean all of them are. So more work is needed. Still, I find this very interesting because it sheds some light on our understanding of how stuff ages. And who knows, maybe they'll figure out how to actually make glass younger again in a bit. And then it's just a small step from glass to us. Artificial intelligence is changing the world rapidly, and many of you have asked me to comment on the threat that AI poses for human civilization. Well, thanks for your faith in me, but I feel like I'm not the right person to ask. I think you'll get more out of me telling you what the people think who actually work on the stuff. And today, I have a very interesting result from a survey among 3,000 AI experts. The most interesting result is that they now think AI is going to change the world even faster than they said just a year ago. Let's have a look. This survey was conducted by AI Impacts. That's a project which has been around since 2018 or so. It's an interdisciplinary group of six researchers who, as the name suggests, study the impact of artificial intelligence on society. This recent survey was conducted late last year. For this, they recruited about 2,800 AI researchers selected from among authors of publications on the topic which had appeared in scientific journals. Collectively, the experts give it a 50% chance that we'll have high-level machine intelligence that's comparable to human intelligence or higher by 2047. This is down 13 years from the predictions they made just a year earlier. It's a similar thing with their prediction for the full automation of labor. They see it coming with 50% probability by 2120 or so, but that's down almost 50 years from last year's prediction. I think this basically means that AI is developing faster than even most experts thought it would. About half of them also think that the intelligence explosion argument is correct. This intelligence explosion is a weaker version of what was formerly known as the technological singularity, that once you have programs that are intelligent enough to build more intelligent programs, intelligence will rapidly increase and go God knows where. And some of them are quite worried about what this will bring. While most of them think that highly intelligent AIs will be mostly good, 5% think that it'll be extremely bad, possibly leading to human extinction. Though to me, this raises more questions than it answers. First of all, there's the question, if you think that your work will lead to human extinction, why are you working on it? And even more concerningly, as I've discussed in an earlier episode, about 1 in 5 people think that human extinction would actually be good because humans are bad. This then makes me wonder how big the overlap is between the 10% who think that AI would be good and the 20% who think that human extinction would be good. Okay, but human extinction is still somewhat in the future, presumably. What's coming up first is that we'll be replaced by machines. The survey participants gave their best guesses about when artificial intelligence would be able to replace certain jobs, including the job of AI researchers themselves. They expect it'll take something between 30 and 100 years until AIs research themselves. In this figure, the dots are the median, so what 50% think. The lower end of the bar is 25% and the upper 75%. You can see that the experts say the first jobs to be replaced by AI are everything related to language. That includes reading, transcription, translation, and writing, reaching the level of New York Times best-selling fiction by 2040 or earlier. I guess if I ever want to write my great science fiction series, I better do this soon. These predictions make sense because language generation is one of the AI tasks that have been most explored so far. The other most obvious advances we've seen recently are with visuals and audio. These experts say that before 2040, we'll see an AI-generated song in the top 40. Personally, I think it'll happen much sooner, within the next couple of years. They also think that truck drivers will become obsolete by 2050 and surgeons by 2100. One thing to note, though, is that these predictions are not just about artificial intelligence. They mix AI together with advances in robot technology and also sociology, politics, and psychology. For example, the question of whether retail salespeople will be replaced by AI isn't just about whether it's possible to do that. It also has a lot to do with whether humans will accept this change. And it's a strange but true fact that humans are most interested in other humans. Think about it. Most dogs can easily outrun the fastest humans. But we don't really care. We want to know what humans can do. Humans are also fascinated by humans who produce photorealistic paintings, which is incredibly odd, given that you could just take a photo, isn't it? Maybe it doesn't make sense, but we do, as a matter of fact, care who did something and how it was done. It's not just about the result, it's about the effort. So I think that as long as there are human customers, there'll also be human salesmen and human creators, until the AIs decide that we're really just an annoyance and get rid of us entirely. I'm fascinated by science deniers, flat earthers, anti-vaxxers, climate change deniers. It's just amazing to see how badly the human brain can malfunction. Of course, it's not just a brain problem, it's also a social problem. In particular, the fraction of climate change deniers differs strongly by country, and it's especially high in the United States. According to a 2020 survey from YouGov, about 19% of Americans think that climate change is either not happening or we're not causing it. In Germany, it's about 10%, and in the UK, 6%. So you see, that's quite a difference. But just why do people keep on believing something that conflicts with bulks of evidence? And why, Americans in particular, do they have alternative facts or alternative brains, maybe? Well, it turns out I'm not the only German who's interested in what's wrong with Americans. A group of Germans recently set out to study the matter. The results are just in, and they're quite surprising. You see, the leading hypothesis for why people refuse to accept evidence that climate change is happening and caused by humans is what psychologists call motivated reasoning. This doesn't mean people are super motivated to give reasons for what they're doing, but rather it means that they have motives for coming up with reasons. They seek out information to confirm beliefs that they want to hold on to. And sure, there are good motivations to not want to believe in climate change. If you don't believe that we are causing climate change, there's no need to worry about how much carbon dioxide your old pickup truck is pumping into the atmosphere. And all that talk about sea level rise is bollocks until the water's in your basement. But about that new paper. To see if motivated reasoning is behind climate change denial in America, the authors recruited 4,000 American adults, had them fill in questionnaires about their political orientation, and then put them into groups of about 800 people each. In the first part of the experiment, the participants of groups 1 and 2 received $20 each. Those in the first group could either donate the money to an organization fighting climate change or keep it for themselves. What do you think how many of them kept the money? About 41%. In the second group, they could only choose between two different organizations to donate to, but not keep the money. After the participants had chosen what to do with the money, they were asked which percentage of climate scientists they think doubt that climate change is human-caused. The authors expected that people who kept the money would say that more climate scientists doubt the evidence so that they justify their actions. However, the replies were almost the same in both groups. In the second part of the experiment, they did the same thing with the money for groups 3 and 4. But afterwards, the researchers asked the participants to watch a video about climate change. The participants had a choice between one video that explained the situation according to the scientific consensus and another one that downplayed the influence of humans. The researchers wanted to see if the participants who kept the money would seek out information to justify climate skepticism. But again, it didn't happen. They checked if the results were dependent on the income of the participants, but found it wasn't. The researchers conclude that Americans don't seem to use motivated reasoning to justify their climate beliefs, and they also don't seem to be seeking out information to support their beliefs. Hey, hey, Americans are more rational than Germans thought. But the researchers did find a strong correlation, and that was with political orientation. A full 60% of Republicans chose the video downplaying climate change, while only 39% of Democrats did. The researchers say this suggests that climate change denial in the United States has little to do with reasoning to begin with, and it's instead strongly tied to political orientation and identity. This political polarization was just recently mapped in a new study that clearly shows climate change denial is particularly strong in those US states which lean Republican. I find this very interesting because from my interaction with climate change deniers, I'm sure that most of them misunderstand the science. And I don't think it's deliberate. I think they're honestly confused. Because the science is difficult and it's hard to find good explanations. I say this because it's taken me quite some time to at least roughly sort out what the science says. And I have a PhD in physics and a friend who's a climate scientist. Psychologists say facts don't change minds. But maybe that has to do with the way that facts are presented in their studies. Because in the real world, facts do change minds. If they didn't, why should we worry about scientific misinformation? Because that could, I don't know, change people's mind? I believe that many science communicators just want to believe that facts don't change minds so that they don't have to explain how we know the facts are facts. Then again, that's just what I believe. A lot of climate targets are lip confessions, but some of those confessions get written into law, and that can create some interesting tensions between what governments and companies say they're doing and what the data say they're doing. In the past weeks, we've seen examples of this tension between words and reality in Japan, the EU, and the USA. In Japan, Toyota has to answer a lot of questions after it turned out that they manipulated the results of emission tests again. In Europe, lawmakers have been officially informed that their regulations on car emissions have had absolutely no effect. And in the United States, scientists urged the Biden administration to reconsider the export of liquefied natural gas. Let's look at those a little closer. End of January, Toyota suspended the production of 10 vehicles, including the Hilux truck and Land Cruiser 300 SUV. This decision came after an independent panel uncovered irregularities on certifications for emission tests dating back as far as 1989. The problem concerns three diesel engines developed by Toyota Industries that were equipped with software which smoothed power output tests with the certainly entirely accidental result of making the cars look more environmentally friendly than they are. Toyota is not new to the problem. Already in 2022, it turned out that one of their company's divisions faked emission data for forklift and construction machinery vehicles. According to Fortune magazine, Toyota CEO Koji Sato said that the company has an issue with understanding and respect with regards to certification, which is is one way to put it. You might remember that a similar thing happened in 2015 with Volkswagen, whose emissions scandal became known as Dieselgate. The problem surfaced after the American Environmental Protection Agency noticed that Volkswagen had installed software in its diesel vehicles that allowed them to pass regulatory tests while emitting higher levels of pollutants during real-world driving conditions. Now, the pollutants in case of Dieselgate were nitrous oxides, not carbon dioxide, but the underlying issue is the same. Companies clearly find emission regulations somewhat annoying and come up with creative solutions to try and avoid them. I wouldn't be surprised at all if it turns out that many other companies are doing, or at least have been doing, the same. A certain lack of understanding and respect with regards to certification, as the Japanese CEO said so nicely. But let's move on and look at what's going on with car emissions in the European Union. An organization independent of the European Parliament has recently found that the European regulations on car exhausts didn't do what they were supposed to do, which was to bring down carbon dioxide emissions in transport. This report comes from the European Court of Audit, whose task it is to basically have an eye on what the European Parliament does. They found that carbon dioxide emissions from cars have not dropped at all since the EU introduced its climate targets in 2012. The major reason for this, the report reveals, is that while car engines have gotten cleaner, cars have also gotten heavier and larger. They say that the average car mass in the EU has increased by approximately 10% between 2011 and 2022, accompanied by a 25% surge in engine power. As a result, most cars on the road in the EU still emit roughly the same amount of carbon dioxide as they did 12 years ago. They found that this holds even for hybrid cars, which according to the audit generally produce much higher carbon dioxide emissions in the real world on the road than predicted by tests in the manufacturer's laboratories. Surprise! The auditors say that emissions reductions will require more stringent checks on car manufacturers and that the EU needs to revise emission targets in light of the new data, both of which are probably good recommendations that'll do very little. Finally, we have scientists urging the United States government to rethink whether liquefied natural gas, LNG for short, is an improvement for the environment. LNG, just as a reminder, is primarily methane, which, just as a reminder, is an extremely potent greenhouse gas. When burned, it releases energy and leaves behind water and carbon dioxide, which, just as a reminder, is also a greenhouse gas. Doesn't sound all that great for the climate, does it? But the fossil fuel industry has tried to position LNG as a stepping stone on the way to net zero because it has lower carbon dioxide emissions than coal and oil. And indeed, it leaves behind only about half as much carbon dioxide per energy produced as coal and still less than oil. This is one of the major reasons why the Europeans, especially us poor Germans who don't have nuclear power, are importing gas from the United States. Yes, we do have a lot of coal, but we're being told to not dig it up. Of course, we do it anyway, but heating with coal is an ugly mess, and so American gas is very welcome. But how much better for the climate is the so-called natural gas really? Well, new studies have found that the previous estimates that it's half as bad as coal were somewhat, shall we say, incomplete. They didn't take into account how much of the methane leaks during production and transport, and these leaks, it turns out, make a substantial contribution to global warming. A new report now says that the numbers on methane leaks, which mostly came from the companies who are selling the stuff, turned out to not be terribly reliable. Surprise! They find that with more reliable data, the life cycle emissions that take into account all greenhouse gases throughout production and use are at least 24% higher for natural gas than for coal. Yes, they say that gas is actually worse than coal, at least when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. This prompted climate scientists to write an open letter to the US president, which attracted 170 signatures. They call on the president not to go through with plans to increase the export of natural gas, and in particular urge him to not build a new export terminal in Louisiana. Hello?
Olaf?
The German Chancellor. All right, what's up? Yes, the report says coal is actually better, but... Olaf? Time crystals. Sounds like something from Hogwarts, but it's actually solid-state physics. Maybe not quite as mysterious as the name suggests, but nonetheless interesting. A team of physicists has now built the most robust time crystal ever and even figured out what these things could be good for. Let's have a look. A normal crystal is a regular configuration of atoms that repeats in each direction of space. A time crystal is a configuration of atoms that repeats both in space and in time. It oscillates, basically. But the funny thing is that it's not a type of oscillation anyone expected or even thought of, except for Frank Wilczek, who proposed time crystals in 2012. Wilczek has already won one Nobel Prize, and he's on a very promising track for a second one, either with the time crystals or with axions, which are a type of dark matter particle which experiments are looking for all over the globe. But today's topic is not dark matter, it's time crystals. Can we agree that physicists, if nothing else, at least have the coolest terminology? Time crystals are a new type of self-organization in solids, basically. They oscillate, kind of like some chemical reactions can, surprisingly enough, oscillate. Unfortunately, in physics, it doesn't look as impressive as in chemistry. I've really studied the wrong field to end up on YouTube. Wilczek's original idea was that some materials could oscillate all on their own, but it turned out that this isn't compatible with energy conservation. The material needs to be supplied with energy. But a few years after Wilczek proposed the idea, the first experiments managed to create the time crystals for real. In such experiments, the energy is typically supplied by shooting with a laser at some kind of material. Some materials then begin some sort of oscillation in response. This oscillation can even continue after the lasers are turned off. Now, if you poke a material with a periodic oscillation and you get a periodic response, that's nice, but kind of unsurprising. If I periodically complain about particle physicists, I also get periodic responses. However, you can also create time crystals if the energy that you supply doesn't generate a beat on its own. This is then called a continuous time crystal, and this is also what they did in this new work. A continuous time crystal has its own internal periodicity. Continuous time crystals have previously been generated in clouds of ultra-cold atoms, for example in 2022 by researchers in Hamburg, Germany. These clouds are typically made of a few 10,000 atoms. When the atoms are cooled to near zero, they create what's called a Bose-Einstein condensate. Yes, this guy again. If the cloud of atoms is cold enough to form a Bose-Einstein condensate, this means it has quantum properties throughout. This means in particular it can behave like both a particle and a wave. The researchers then supplied it with energy from electromagnetic waves and it responded. In this example, they saw an oscillation in the number density at a frequency of a few milliseconds, nothing to do with the frequency of the radiation. So, a time crystal. What makes these time crystals so interesting is that they display an entirely new physical phenomenon. Honestly, I think at the moment physicists don't really know what it's good for. There's been some talk about using it for quantum computing, but I can't really see how this would work. Timekeeping is a possibility, because every time you have something that reliably oscillates, you can use that as a pacemaker. But we already have highly reliable atomic clocks, and a cloud of atoms cooled to some millikelvin isn't going to revolutionize wristwatches, especially not if these things oscillate barely a few milliseconds in total. And this then brings me to the new paper. In this experiment, researchers from the Technical University in Dortmund, Germany, managed to produce a time crystal that lasted a full 40 minutes. That's more than a million times longer than the previous ones. Quite an achievement. For this, they used a semiconductor made from indium gallium arsenide doped with silicon at a temperature of about 6 degrees above absolute zero. Then they shot at it with a laser. The material's spin states began to oscillate at a period of about 6 seconds. So it's not like the oscillation is a deformation of the material, it's a periodic back and forth of the spins. I know this sounds somewhat academic, but I find this totally fascinating. It's just not what you expect a semiconductor to do. And that oscillation was remarkably stable, as you can see in this figure. They also noticed that the oscillation period is very sensitive to changes in the magnetic field and temperature. For this reason, they suggest that such materials might one day come in handy as sensors, in which one could infer changes in the magnetic field or temperature from the oscillation frequency. I'm not joking when I say Frank Wilczek might well end up winning another Nobel Prize. You see, it was a similar story with topological insulators. Those are materials with unique electric properties. For example, they might only conduct electricity on the surface, but not in the bulk. The idea came out of theoretical work by Thulis, Haldane and Kostelitz about 25 years ago. At first, no one had any idea what it might be good for, just like today with the time crystals. But in 2016, they won the Nobel Prize, because by then their idea had found applications in some types of high-speed electronics. So it might well be that time crystals will soon find an application, and Wilczek is up for another Nobel Prize. Science has a big problem, and it's been getting rapidly worse in the past 2 years or so, to no small part because of recent advances in artificial intelligence. Fraudulent papers are getting published more than ever, and the fraudsters are getting increasingly aggressive. In this episode, I want to give you an update on the recent developments. According to data collected by Nature magazine, the number of retracted papers hit an all-time record in 2023, with more than 10,000. Most of these papers were not retracted because of honest mistakes, but because they contain fabricated crap, sham data, AI-generated text, repurposed figures and images. The number of retractions is rising faster than the total number of publications. About 2 in 1,000 scientific papers are now being retracted. The number of retracted papers isn't the same as the number of fraudulent papers, but it's unlikely that the identification of fraud has suddenly gotten much better. More likely, it's become more difficult as AI gets better. This also means that the number of fraudulent papers has been skyrocketing. But this number might look more alarming than it is, so let me give you some context. Most retractions happen in Saudi Arabia, followed by Pakistan, Russia, China, and Egypt. It's predominantly an Eastern problem, and most of these retractions come from one publisher, Hindavi, and they mostly come from special issues. Special issues have become a special issue in publishing, so to speak. The idea of special issues was that you'd have collections of papers on one particular topic, typically some type of recent development for which there wasn't a dedicated journal. This makes sense. The problem is that the editorial process of these special issues was outsourced to guest editors, who then basically invited their friends to submit papers that were essentially guaranteed to get published. As time went on, special issues became basically junkyards of scam papers that were waved through by those guest editors, which were not accountable to anyone or anything. The journals didn't do much about it because, you see, they sell subscriptions to their content regardless of what that content is. So researchers were constantly getting spammed with calls to contribute to those special issues. And if you had a need to get some paper published without much effort, this was the way to do it. Now, Hindavi is a subsidiary of the publisher Wiley, and Wiley has meanwhile recognized the special issue. They have announced some major changes, and they say they'll stop using the Hindavi brand altogether. I'm not sure that's going to solve the problem, but this makes me think that the rapid increase in retractions will probably not continue like this. However, there's more trouble at the door. A lot of this increase in rubbish publications is driven by what's become known as paper mills in academic publishing. These are semi-legal networks of people who produce scam papers and guide them to publication. They usually do this for academics who pay money. Typically, they'll be offering authorship on a paper with a particular topic, and the price depends on where you want to be in the author list. These paper mills are believed to first have originated in China, where academics are often paid for papers, or even if not, papers are required for promotions. But the practice has since spread to Russia and India, and reportedly also to Iran and Eastern Europe. A lot of these papers are published in areas that concern public health, such as drug development or psychology. Drug development in particular seems to have been a target because papers on this topic all look and sound more or less the same. You just need to swap the name of one drug for another. This makes these paper mills very dangerous because these fake papers can get cited in support of useless drugs, as seems to have happened with the controversial drug ivermectin. In the past, many of these papers have been easy to spot because the language is sometimes funny. This has become known as tortured phrases, probably stemming from automated systems trying to rewrite technical terms. For example, in some cases, the word magnetic resonance became attractive reverberations. An article from Times Higher Education has more funny examples. Fuzzy logic, a research area in mathematics, turned to fluffy rationale. Breast cancer into bosom peril. Renal failure became a kidney disappointment, and an ant colony turned into a subterranean insect province. The most recent worrying trend is that the paper mills evidently make enough money to simply bribe journal editors into accepting papers. Frederick Irving from the database Retraction Watch recently wrote an article for Science magazine in which he reports an alarming trend. Among recent retractions, those related to bribed editors or other peer review manipulations, such as simply pretending to review a paper with AI-generated text, have steeply increased. And this problem doesn't just affect niche publishers you've never heard of. According to Hewing, a spokesperson for Elsevier said every week its editors are offered cash in return for accepting manuscripts. Sabina Alam, director of Publishing Ethics and Integrity at Taylor & Francis, said bribery attempts have also been directed at journal editors there. The problem is ultimately driven by a scientific system that values the quantity of results in publications over the quality. This is not a new insight, of course, but despite it being well known, not much has been done to address it. And so I'm afraid that as AI becomes better, fraudulent work will creep into more and more scientific disciplines and become increasingly hard to identify. You know, maybe we're actually better off if we just leave science to AIs entirely. Thanks for watching. See you tomorrow.